Hello, this is D. Roberts Keenan with Smart TV, coming to you with a commentary track on Desperate Housewives, Season 1, Episode 9, Suspicious Minds. This is the first in 7 commentary tracks I'll be doing for Smart TV on different shows on how they relate to the 7 Deadly Sins. Coming up today is the first and arguably most serious of the Deadly Sins, the Sin of Pride. The 7 Deadly Sins have been around for centuries. There was a Greek theologian, I believe, in the 4th or 5th century who originally came up with a list of 8 sins. In order of sort of increasing seriousness, we had gluttony, lust, greed, sadness or depression, wrath, acedia, which is sort of a spiritual apathy, vainglory, which is sort of ostentatious display or sort of boastful pride, and then pride up at the top. It wasn't until the 6th century when sort of Pope Gregory dropped the list down to 7 items. He put vainglory into pride, where it's almost a synonym. He folded acedia, that sort of spiritual ennui, into sadness, and he added the sin of envy. And the way he ranked the sins was depending on how much they sort of offended against love, against God. From the most serious to the least, we've got pride, envy, anger, sadness, greed, gluttony, and lust. Many other theologians throughout the centuries have talked about the ranking of the 7 deadly sins and whether they could be ranked and whether they ought to be. And Thomas Aquinas really was one of the more famous proponents of the idea that we should not rank them in this way. So, I mean, it's if for much more lengthy and sort of interesting discussion, there's a website, excellent resource, called deadlysins.com. It's got all sorts of cool stuff on the history of the 7 deadly sins. Today, as it stands, as I said before, we've got pride, envy, anger, sloth, greed, gluttony, and lust. Those are the 7 as they stand now. Sadness is no longer a sin. You can be sad or, depressed. It's kind of interesting to think that once upon a time you could have been sent straight to hell for needing Prozac. Anyway, what a wonderful world it is in which we live. There are, in addition to the deadly sins, there's also some virtues that will counteract that. The 7 contrary virtues, humility, kindness, abstinence, chastity. Remember, abstinence and chastity were not always the same thing. Patience, generosity, and diligence. So, if you would like to guard against the deadly sins, then that's how you would go ahead and do it. We've just started the brilliant opening credit scene of Desperate Housewives. There's something really special about this, the way that it sort of goes through history, the way that it sort of uses famous artworks, the sort of thrilling little Danny Elfman sort of theme that goes on here. It's a pity that not too many TV shows actually bother to do credit sequences anymore. And it's nice to see that when a television show does go for it, that it really does pull out all the stops and make it something as special and as memorable as this scene is right here. For those of you who've never seen the show, and I'm hoping that's not many of you, Desperate Housewives centers around a mystery of sorts. Why did their best friend kill herself? But it also really depends on the interactions between these characters. And one of the best interactions is right here between Nicolette Sheridan as Edie Britt and between Terry Hatcher as Susan Meyer. One of the many, many ways that pride manifests itself throughout the show, but in this particular episode in particular, is how vain these women are. Vanity was the original name for pride. And we've got sort of you know, we've got these vain women sort of trying to make themselves look just sort of gussied up, very beautiful, and then, you know, they're going to go out, and it's never really established how this is going to, you know, do charity work, but, you know, it is sort of an interesting spin on how this has happened. One would never think of using sin to do good in, say, the Middle Ages, in, you know, even at the turn of the century, perhaps. But today, this is such a common occurrence. We use, for example, you know, these charity fashion shows, which is vanity on display. You know, sex sells. You know, you see, for example, breast cancer advertisements that are arguably sort of, you know, sexy and edgy. And, you know, the goal is to get you to donate money. You know, they put, you know, fashionable celebrities and that sort of thing. But you would, you know, traditionally, you know, and I say traditionally is going back sort of hundreds of years, but you would never, ever see sin being used to sell virtue. And that's exactly what we're doing here, where we are using the sin of pride in order to benefit charity, in order to benefit love, which is sort of an odd little turnaround. For those of you who've missed it entirely, we just had an oh-so-clever joke about Mrs. Huber in, you know, not being caught dead in a particular dress. So, blah, blah, blah. Paul, if you read any of the Television Without Pity recaps, you will know that Paul is probably the stupidest human being alive next to Susan Meyer. He's burying Mrs. Huber with compromising evidence, with, you know, in what looks to be like 2 feet of dirt here. And while I can't go ahead for sure and say that that Mark Cherry, the creator and head writer of the show, and, you know, that he intended for that to sort of be a display of pride, one could certainly make an argument that Paul's burial of Mrs. Huber in such a shoddy fashion sort of shows that he thinks he's above the law, that he thinks that, you know, he's not going to get caught, he's not going to be facing any consequences for this, which is in itself a type of pride. Each of the characters in this show and in this episode exhibits pride in some sort of special way. Gabrielle really is the embodiment of all of these different types of pride coming together. Gabrielle is vain, she's selfish, she is, you know, proud in the traditional sense of what she has accomplished. She's vainglorious, you know, she's given into these ostentatious displays. There's something special about her character in this episode. This really is a very strong Gabby episode. And if you haven't been following the show, you need to start, because it looks as though for season 2 that Gabrielle is shaping up to deliver, you know, another really terrific character arc. A lot of people diss on Lynette. I don't know why. I think Felicity Huffman is an incredible, incredible actress. The way that she plays the scene with Gay Matt from Melrose Place, I mean... she's so naturalistic, she's so well-developed as a character. And in this particular episode, I would argue that she is perhaps the most realistic, the least prideful of any of the characters in this show. She is sort of humility embodied. She knows she needs help. And of course, she goes to humorous sitcom lengths to get it. But she's not afraid to ask for help when she needs it. She's not afraid to tell her husband, you know, here's the deal. I can't deal with this. Here we've got an interesting twist on pride, because in any normal show, Bree and Rex would be sitting down and they'd be having a conversation about, you know, oh, aren't we proud of our son Andrew? And go Andrew, he's going to win the race. Well, Andrew does win the race, and, you know, the twist in this little scene is that Bree and Rex completely miss it. Where they should be showing pride, where it would be appropriate for them to be showing pride, it just completely passes them by. this is a key theme that's running through this particular arc for Andrew, the son of Brian Rex. He, of course, has hit Mama Solis, put her sort of in the hospital in a coma, and he doesn't really care. The reason why he doesn't really care is something that we haven't explored fully, but Andrew's got his own stuff going on, and while I don't want to spoil too much of what happens in the later season, if you haven't seen those episodes yet, you really do want to catch up. Andrew's going through a lot of stuff, and here, you know, here he's obviously showing a great show of, you know, a great show of sort of deserved pride. He should be proud of himself. He's just sort of won this athletic competition. But that, you know, as if you've ever watched television, you know that what writers, what producers love to do is they set up a situation, and just when things start to look good, that's when they find a way to twist the dagger. So in this particular instance, as, you know, as Andrew, as Bree and Rex are allowed to show some sort of, you know, healthy sort of deserved pride in their accomplishments and what they've been able to do, the show is going to sort of twist that and subvert it so that things aren't really going to be so happy anymore. And there's a great sort of payback scene that comes up with that a little bit later. Here we show some of the sort of selfishness of Gabby. This borders sort of on envy, sort of on jealousy, which is another of the seven deadly sins, but I think it really fits in well here. She's too selfish a person to want John to be seeing anybody else. And the idea of him with another woman is something that's very off-putting to her. And I don't think it's because she's jealous of him, you know, regardless of what other episodes might uncover about the character. In this particular instance, it really is Gabrielle being completely selfish. And, you know, Susan Meyer here, Terry Hatcher, who sees what Gabby is doing, she's going to have a great big, you know, sort of knockdown, drag-out argument with her. And here we are. And Susan is really calling Gabby out on being selfish, on being this person who has no sort of respect for anyone else's feelings, you know, no respect for anything, in fact, other than her own orgasm. You know, if we also go back to the Middle Ages, we can talk about how the orgasm, you know, was considered something that was, you know, one of the root causes of all evil. You know, why would women be vain? It was because they wanted to, you know, they wanted to pretty themselves up so they could attract a man so that they could have an orgasm. An orgasm was considered something really awful for women to have. And to men, too, for a lesser extent. You know, there was only one acceptable method of achieving orgasm, and that was, you know, sort of missionary position, man on top, you know, full vaginal intercourse to, you know, making babies. Sex for pleasure wasn't something that was approved of. Masturbation certainly wasn't something that was approved of. And lest you think I'm getting a little bit too much into lust, let me remind you that many, many scholars of the seven deadly sins believe that pride is sort of the gateway sin. You know, pride is the marijuana of the sin world. Marijuana being, of course, the ludicrous and mythical gateway drug that Nancy Reagan would have you believe is going to get you started onto that whole other path to, you know, sort of degradation. But, you know, really, the pride here is what we're discussing, and the pride as it leads into everything else. Now, Lynette is showing a little bit of the cutthroat tactics, and this is a fine line for this particular character. She is humble enough to realize that she needs help, yet she is confident enough, and sort of that sort of exaggerated confidence, that braggadocio, can be, you know, can lead to pride. But I think here Lynette plays it pretty well, that sort of balance between the extreme confidence and the realization that she needs help in asking Bree what to do. Back with Gabby and John. It's a little interesting to see these two react and to know, you know, certainly to know what comes later, you know, what comes in later episodes, and to watch the great, great chemistry between them in these early episodes. What's terrific, too, is watching, you know, here we've got Bree and Andrew smoking pot out the window, you know, watching the chemistry between those two. That's a really interesting, really terrific relationship. That's something I think people tend to poo-poo about Desperate Housewives, but the fact of the matter is Desperate Housewives really showcases some unique, terrifically fleshed out relationships, and that's what this show is about. It's not about the murder, it's not about the suicide, it's not about the tricks and turns and twists and yada yada. It really is about how these people relate to one another. An interesting note, if you noticed in like the last episode, Andrew had his door removed as punishment for like 3 months, but apparently, you know, either 3 months have passed or they've just forgotten about it because he's got his door back now. You should probably rewind this without my talking over it, because this is a hilarious, hilarious little moment with Andrew sort of completely stoned and trying to act as if he's sort of deep in thought about what he's done. And that's just a terrific little bit of writing there. And I love how Bree, in sort of her, see, this is the vainglory coming out here. This is the land of the ostentatious display of everything must be perfect, everything must be just right. So we have Bree going for the salad dressing container. I love that she's got like multiple bits of Tupperware that nobody actually uses, you know. I mean, yeah. But anyway, here we are again. Here we are with Paul. Paul being the stupidest human alive, with the exception of Susan, you know. I suppose I should apologize right now if you think I'm influenced a little too much by television without pity. I think that's a hilarious sight. I think the recaps of those episodes are quite funny, and sometimes some of the little stuff gets stuck in my head. You'll have to shoot me if you ever hear me referring to Bree as Kimber Bree, but, you know, the little snide bits about Gay Matt, you know, from Melrose Place, and, you know, Paul being just an idiot, I'm certainly happy to steal. Here, John, he's saying, you know, we talk about real stuff. She doesn't treat me like some lame yard boy. And in a way, John is attracted to Gabrielle because she makes him feel proud. You know, she makes him feel like what he wants to be. She makes him feel like more than what he is. He is a lame high school yard boy, but in Gabrielle's arms, he's something much more. And he really gets drawn to that sort of power. You know, here we've got sort of the pride of Paul Young, in that he thinks he's certainly above the rules, and this, of course, comes crashing down. He can't sustain that level. He simply can't do it. And so his son ends up running away from the mental institution. And of course, where does he go? He goes across the street to be with Julie. Which, aside from providing comic complications for Susan, you know, eventually, is something that, you know, something that also makes us reflect upon this sort of theme of pride running through this particular episode. Why does he go there? Why is, you know, he's humble enough to seek help, but at the same time, he knows he can manipulate Julie, and sort of, you know, he's using that knowledge, he's using that to get his way. Very similar to what Lynette is doing here, where she is, you know, she is attempting to manipulate this, you know, she's attempting to manipulate this nanny that she needs. But, you know, as you see, Lynette has a couple of missteps. She's not able to, you know, she's not able to sweet talk her way into it. She's not able to call upon that, you know, right away. Part of that, I would imagine, comes from just dramatic complications, that setup that, you know, we have to introduce the conflict and we have to have complications and then we can have the resolution. And that is something that, of course, is very anti-true to life, that is really a common thread throughout pretty much every single television show ever invented. At the same time, it's interesting to note what that says about the characters. I've mentioned this before, about the payoff that we're going to be getting between Bree and Rex. This is one of the highlights of season one, and most of my highlights from season one do come from the interactions between Bree and Rex. There's a terrific hotel scene, you might recall, with her in her lingerie, and there's this right here, which is just brilliant. It's so ludicrous if you think about it. What sort of insane parent is going to, you know, is going to force her son to pee into a salad dressing bottle? That's a very telling remark Rex just made. You always make decisions and then tell me that I agree. I love how he's got wrinkle-resistant pants. Or the stain-resistant pants. It's just a great moment where Bree just flings it at him. And then what a great tag. And I just talked through it. What, you know, if you were my mom, I'd smoke pot too. Well, there, you know, that's so funny on so many levels. This is Marla Sokoloff. I think she used to be on The Practice. I'm pretty sure that's where I've seen her from. She reminds me a lot of Lacey Chabert, who used to be on Party of Five. But I think they're sort of like that sort of young, like sort of, they just got that quality to them. I guess there were a lot of young actresses at the time who really looked very similar. Jennifer Love Hewitt's got the same thing going on, but I don't know. Here we've got, you know, Alexis is the, you know, the sort of heard off screen but never really explored embodiment of just crazy, crazy, whacked out sort of, you know, selfish pride in action. Alexis, you know, makes this nanny character do sort of all sorts of horrible things and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And then I think that makes Lynette realize that, you know what? She really, you know, she might have gone off the deep end a little bit, but she's still pretty okay. I love that we actually get to see Susan working in this scene. She's supposed to be like a children's book writer, illustrator. And I think it's interesting that the only place that she can work that's sort of clean and uncluttered is sort of outdoors. That tells me a lot about Susan's character. John, of course, trying to explain things. And as with sort of any sort of, you know, French sex farce, you know, really any sitcom since Three's Company, which pretty much was a French sex farce, you know, we've got the touching that's not meant to be romantic but is construed that way because somebody doesn't know all the facts. And this is an old, old complication. I'm sure it's been used back as well as far back as, you know, the earliest playwrights. But it's an oldie, but it's a goodie. It really works. And that's just another aspect to the sin of pride. This, I think I know better. You know, I don't know all the facts. I can't see the complete picture. I can't use all of my five senses. But I know better than you do. That's something, that's a trap Gabrielle finds herself in. You know, she thinks she knows the best. She knows the best way to do everything. You know, here in this one limited instance, she really does. She can shine. This is her area of expertise. Although it is a little bit odd that, you know, a woman of, like, you know, 4'7" would have been a professional runway model. But that's kind of beside the point. The women here look lovely. And they're... Here we've got Edie, who is vanity personified. You know, she's taken that sort of dowdy pantsuit and she's turned it into sort of this revealing sort of skirt. Now, I need to be perfectly honest. We see Susan in this dress, and I do not think it's that attractive. I know everyone is just sort of gushing over it, but, I mean, Susan, frankly, just sort of stands out and not in a great way. For my money, I think Bree's dress is brilliant, especially because it, you know, it looks so much like the character. It's exactly what you'd expect that character to be wearing. But, you know, here, you know, this white thing, it looks like it was designed to be torn off her, which is what it's a prop dress, you know, and that's what ends up happening. Yeah. This fashion show is really fun. If you continue to look on this DVD, you'll see more of the fashion show. You'll see some of the deleted stuff. I love that. That's such a great moment between Lynette and her husband. You know, he's obviously very proud of her, and that's one of the healthy ways of pride, you know, the well-deserved pride. He's very proud of his wife because, you know, she's very beautiful and very well put together. Here we have a great example of the idiot plot, where the simple misunderstanding could be cleared up completely, you know, with two words, but... You know, of course, Helen just goes completely off the deep end. You know, granted, makes for some, you know, for some great comedy in the context of the show. But, I mean, come on. You know, it's so ludicrous that she, you know, that she would just walk up to another woman and hit her. Instead of saying, you know, why are you sleeping with my son? And then Susan can explain, I'm not sleeping with your son. And then we can all go... You know, we can all sort of breathe that collective sigh of relief. I must say, on a lesser show, this would be played completely wrongly. Here, the humor really comes from Susan's humiliation, from her embarrassment. She hasn't yet completed her character arc for the season. She hasn't yet become any sort of a confident woman at all. And, you know, her pride lies almost entirely within the realm of the selfish, as opposed to the realm of the vain. Susan here, in a lesser show, would have come across and would have strutted her stuff and would have looked fantastic, and, you know, everyone would have sort of oohed and awed and applauded, you know. Here we don't see that. We really do see the humiliation of Susan for what it is. And it's compounded by the fact that she's the innocent here. I mean, Gabrielle is the one at fault. And it's Gabrielle's selfishness, it's Gabrielle's pride, it's Gabrielle's vanity, it's Gabrielle's vainglory that keeps Susan from succeeding here. And that is really the big lesson of this show, that other people's actions affect you. And because we are all so close and so connected to one another, that the way other people treat you, the things other people do, will come back on you. And, you know, I think that it's something that can be said about the strength of this particular show, that we do allow ourselves this sort of time, this sort of breathing room, to explore the relationships between these characters. As I said before, it's not about the murder, it's not about the suicide, it's not about any of the other intrigue that comes with Desperate Housewives, the water cooler talking points. The real strength of this show, the real solid nature of this show, is and always will be, I think, in the strength of the relationships between these characters. We end up caring about these characters, and we are sort of sad when they are sad, and we are sort of happy when they are happy, even when they're happy and sad for the wrong reasons. But because we all identify so well with these characters, that really is what leads this to be such a complete and wonderful experience on its own. Nice little scene with Julie and Zach here. I think Zach is painting things a little bleaker than they are. Yes, he's been sort of taken to a mental hospital and forcibly drugged, but yeah, the kid is weird, and the kid's got problems. And I think I'm not too far off the mark if I suggest that it's another type of pride that leads Zach sort of unable to see what he's been doing lately. Julie, too, is another sort of sweet one. She's sort of an innocent one. She's coming at this from a completely different angle. She's coming at this whole relationship with Zach from a charity angle, as a way to say, you're somebody I need to help. The fact that she's not really in a position to be helping anyone compounds that a little bit. Another great Brie moment as she sort of sneaks into her son's locker to plant his pot. I love that Brie gets to get away with the most ridiculous, I mean, absolutely plot developments. And she is so anal and so passive-aggressive. And she is just so completely whacked out and out there. But there's a bit of truth in that, because we all know women who are partially like Brie. You know, maybe not all at once, but, you know, we all know women who do the Martha Stewart thing way too well. You know, we all know women who are just complete control freaks. We all know women who are so passive-aggressive. We all know little bits and pieces, and so putting them all together into one package, really sort of points up the comedy and the drama of this. Here we've got Zach's sort of false memory. And it's interesting how he's managed to think for all these years that he's killed a baby sister without ever talking about it, without ever sort of dealing with it, while not trying to spoil too much of this for people who haven't seen the latter episodes of this season one. I will point out that what Zach thinks is not what happened, you know. There's definitely more to the story. And I think here Zach really is being very manipulative. I think he's being very calculating in knowing what he wants, which is to stay with Julie, which is to be with Julie, whom he has this sort of crush on, and how he can make her feel empathy toward him. I think this is a very Machiavellian character, and I think he's wise beyond his years, and I don't mean that as a compliment. I think his father has really rubbed off on him. His father strikes me as a very sort of cold, sort of humorless sort of person, and granted, the circumstances might have made him into, you know, someone like that. But here, I think Zach is too prideful, and I think he knows exactly what he's after, and he takes these steps to go get it. And here he gets exactly what he wants, which is to be physical with Julie. And as you know, between two 14-year-olds, a kiss is the same thing as going all the way. This is the first moment where Gabrielle is going to swallow her pride, and she's going to tell the truth to John's mother. This, of course, is the major character arc for this episode, where, you know, Gabrielle must realize that she's being, you know, an uber queen bitch, and she's going to come clean. This is not something that's very comfortable for Gabrielle. I don't think she's used to apologizing. In fact, I don't think she's used to having things her way, you know, having things not her way ever. You know, I find that interesting, that she's been sleeping with John for almost a year, and she hasn't gotten tired of him yet. I'm really surprised that John hasn't gotten tired of her yet, because I can't imagine how such a sweet kid like John would ever be attracted to, you know, would ever be attracted to Gabrielle. Now, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think Gabrielle's a terrific character. I think she's funny, you know, and I think, you know, she's great to watch. But if you ever knew anyone like that, there is no way that you would be their friend for longer than about 45 seconds. I mean, it would be too exhausting. You know. I love this moment because, you know, Andrew knows exactly how that got there. And, you know, he can't say anything, you know, because it's his mother. You know, what's he gonna, oh, my mother put a pot in my locker, you know. But at the same time, you know, I mean, come on. It's just such a great moment. And then here we've got Bree, who, in this great display of vainglory, is finishing up her flower display. This is some of the mystery stuff, you know. This sort of takes away what, for me, is the real thrust of the show, the character relationships, and so we find ourselves back in the mystery. But thankfully, not for too long, as we've got Susan back, and Susan. This is a really interesting moment for her, as she states, as she knows, as she describes that she can, you know, she can state categorically that her daughter is not a liar and her daughter would never lie. And of course, what's really going on here is that her daughter is lying to her. Her daughter is deceiving her. Her daughter's got Zach stuffed up in her bedroom, you know. And so for Susan to be so blindly trusting, you know, of course, as with any other television show ever written, you know, throughout the history of the medium, of course we're going to find out that Julie's lying. And of course we're going to find out that Susan really can't trust her daughter. And, you know, just when you set up something as being a paragon of virtue and perfection, of course that's when we're going to expose it for what it really is. That's just the way TV works. That's the way all television works. And that's the way that if you pay close enough attention to, especially these one-hour shows, I mean, you'll see this, you know, it's not just set up joke, punchline. It's, you know, it's much more about sort of setting up models of a particular theme, models on a particular meditation, and then systematically knocking them down. Sometimes, you know, sometimes they crash and they tumble with a single stroke, and sometimes it's something that's a bit more subtle, you know. In many ways, a lot of TV plot writing is really like taking a Jenga cube and, you know, setting up that Jenga block and then removing the pieces one by one and putting them back in a different order. And the trick is to see how long you can keep drawing this out before the tower crumbles. Here we show the difference between Bree and Rex. And, of course, for Rex, the big thing is not that his son sparked the doobie, as you said he was already okay with, or at least not okay with it. But here his thing is that he didn't even come up with a good lie, you know, with a decent lie to explain how the pot got into his locker. And I think Andrew knows. I think Andrew knows exactly what his mother has done. But his mother, in sort of her pride at trying to keep the family together, at sort of trying to keep things, you know, looking the way that they have to look, that really takes her character to some interesting places. Here Gabby for the second time, she's about to become a real person. She's about to complete her character arc. She's about to stop being so pride, and she's about to humble herself and sort of beg for forgiveness. But she can't bring herself to do it. And it's interesting that she's about to see these lights here. She sees the lights. She thinks they're coming for her, and that's when she decides that she can be humble. When, I mean, the situation forces her to be. This is situational ethics, you know, this moral relativism, whatever you want to call it. But, I mean, this is Gabby in a heart, I mean, just in a nutshell. And this is why I can never bring myself to care too much about what happens to Gabby, because she's just not a really nice person. You know, and like I said before, I think it's a great character. I think it's really well written, and I think it's well played, certainly. But I don't think it's somebody that you'd ever actually want to know in real life. You know, here, of course, the big switch, the big reveal is that it's Carlos who is the criminal and not Gabby. That Gabby is perfectly okay, that, you know, nothing's going to come of this. And this allows Gabrielle to continue sort of her sort of prideful ways in reduced fashion throughout the next several episodes. But, you know, but still, we're starting on a slightly different character arc where we've tweaked the ways in which Gabby can be vain, the ways in which she can be selfish, the ways in which she can exhibit this pride. That's just, you know, I have to wonder, you know, these guys have been inside the house for 4 seconds, and all of a sudden they know where to find and bring out these sort of boxes, you know, whatever. Anyway, we've got the Mary Alice, the voiceover, again, sort of summing up the episode. And so now it's probably a good time for me to start wrapping things up as well. I certainly hope you've enjoyed this commentary track on episode 9 from season 1 of Desperate Housewives, Suspicious Minds. If you pay any attention at all to episode titles, you might have noticed that most of the episode titles are taken after sort of Broadway songs, show tunes. This one is not. It's an Elvis Presley song, and sort of a famous one. I think it was a number one hit of his for quite a while. But it really does. It sums up what the writers want you to think the theme is, certainly, about people being suspicious of one another. However, for me, it doesn't sum up what the real thrust of this episode is, and that is, you know, pride goeth before a fall. You know, pride, I think pride might really be one of the gateway sins here, at least in terms of the way that we're exploring it here. I hope you'll join me the next time that I go ahead and do one of these. As I said, this is the first of seven fabulous episodes. And the next episode, the next show that we'll be doing, we will be talking about the sin of envy. This is D. Roberts Keenan with Smart TV signing off. I hope you've enjoyed, and I hope you'll continue to listen. Thank you.